Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Rolling W's or a K-shaped recovery? While cases rise, new hope for treatments arrive. SPACs are on fire. And we have listener call-in questions answered. All this and much more on episode number 670 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. And a very good day to you. Thanks for tuning in to another episode of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. I'm Andrew Horowitz, the host of TDI, as we call it, the Disciplined Investor Podcast. I'm also president of Horowitz & Company. And remember that this is not kind of a fakey discussion. This is IRL, in real life. This is not some theory from a part-time investor. You're not listening to a podcast that someone decided to put a couple of microphones together and record it, throw it up on iTunes and just spout off what they think. This is what we do all day, every day at Horowitz & Company. We manage money for clients and we work on their financial futures. And what I bring you each and every week is some of the things that we have been talking about in the office, some of the things that we have been looking at and observing. So I think it's important to recognize that this is something that you're getting that is applied, not just theoretical. And, you know, I saw an interesting statistic this week. As of right now, we have over 10 million downloads of the show since we started tracking it. I mean, that's pretty amazing. 10 million. So I want to thank you for listening. Thank you for sharing, sending out a link to the show, and keep on doing it. Get the word out. If you're listening right now and you haven't done so already, do me a favor. Share the show with someone you love and care about so that they can get into shape financially for their future. Now, what about what's been going on this week? We had a generally upbeat tone for the markets, especially in the non-U.S. stock space. China stocks were absolutely on fire. And what happened was we saw that the state-controlled media, they came out with some pretty, I would say, bullish. It has to be bullish. You got to listen to this because, remember, the state and the country owns a lot of the stocks, a lot of the companies that are traded on their stock markets. And they also control the media. And therefore, what they can do is on a regular basis, put out commentary and try to boost the performance of stocks. So what has happened is that they said that, hey, it's probably a good time to start investing in the markets. In fact, on Monday, they put out a report or they put out a news item or somebody wrote a story and it was embedded inside of it that the country said that fostering a healthy bull market is important. It's like kind of your national duty, and it's your duty as a citizen, as an investor. So what does that mean? Well, that it pretty much gave investors the green light to just pour it on. And of course, again, we know the state owns, and when I say the state, the country owns many of the companies that trade on the stock exchange inside of China. So when they come out with this kind of pump campaign, people are thinking, oh my gosh, hey, wait a minute. The state is saying that, hey, it's a good time. They're obviously going to get behind it as well because they're not going to just say it and not do anything about it. So they're going to be pumping money into the system as well, possibly buying some of the shares of their companies. And that, therefore, what happens is that the individuals say, oh, it's all right, I'm in. I'm following right along. And when that happens, it's not the first time this has happened. When that happens, things get pretty crazy over there. People don't just say, okay, I'm going to put a couple of dollars in. They start really, it's a rampage. It's an absolute like bull rush. And markets move dramatically. What's also interesting is that we often see that once this happens, sometime relatively in the next week, 2 weeks or so, they need to tamp down the enthusiasm. This happened before, and it happened on Friday. So on Monday, there's an article out saying, hey, it's a good time to foster a healthy bull market, and it's important to foster a healthy bull market. In other words, hey, get your money into the markets. We're telling you it's a good time to get invested. And markets went up dramatically. By the end of the week, another commentary came out that said, well, you know what? We need to make sure that we're not getting ahead of ourselves or something of that nature. Don't get too excited. Don't get overly excited. Be cautious because, of course, you could lose money in the markets as well. And what happened? Well, the reverse happened. So about a 2% drop on their markets. But this was all week we saw this incredible amount of movement. This is on the heels of already a move up on the markets. The CSI 300 index, for example, was up 10% for the week, and now it's up 15% for the year. It's at a five-year high. Think about all the things that are going on. They had the virus and the major lockdowns. They have all these tariffs put against them. We have threats from the U.S. and other areas around the world about slowing trade and taking trade away from China and moving companies from China to other areas because we're really concerned about the supply chain. And meanwhile, their stock market is up 15% for the year. And there's different markets, the CSI 300, the Shanghai, the Shenzhen. The Hong Kong market, the Hang Seng, is up 2% for the year. And you may say, well, what's that? Big deal, 2% for the year. Think about all the things that are going on in Hong Kong over the last year and that the stock market there is still up. Think about the protests, the riots, the companies moving out of there, the higher level of overall coronavirus, COVID-19 cases there. So there's substantial, unrelenting support from the government for their markets, which is really not that much different than what we have going on here. The difference is that here we have what we believe to be, what we want it to be. Which is capitalism. Over there, I guess we can call it socialized capitalism. But as we go through this whole pandemic and see the amount of money that's spent, whether it be monetary policy, money that's being spent through quantitative easing and low interest rates, or whether it's fiscal policy where we're seeing direct payments to individuals or bailouts of companies or very low-cost loans that are given to various companies that are having a problem, or even the loans that are going to turn into grants through like the PPP program that basically is money that's just being poured on various businesses. I don't know if there's a big difference. I mean, maybe we don't have the state-owned media, but we do know that the White House and the administration that is currently in place right now is a mouthpiece and a cheerleader for the markets. If nothing else, let's just focus in on Larry Kudlow, who is constantly cheerleading, no matter how bad things are. And yes, we need that. It's good. You want to have optimism, but a little bit of a reality check sometimes goes a long way also to make sure that the information that we're receiving can be trusted and believed. But in a time where there's going to be the potential for another $1 trillion that is put into the hands of whether it's states or whether it's individuals, businesses, another $1 trillion on top of the $3 trillion, on top of the $5 trillion, between monetary and fiscal policy. I mean, there's a lot of money that's in the system right now. So no wonder why we have this indirect and this direct payment process going on that is very much similar to what goes on a regular basis, non-emergency, non-pandemic basis in China. And while a lot of people don't trust the information that comes out of China, they don't trust the reports from the official government, whether it's on unemployment or GDP growth, industrial production, industrial profits, service indices, whatever it may be, the fact remains that does that really even matter right now when we have a structure that regardless of what the information flow is, that the government is going to support the markets. And really, I got to tell you, I have been one that, I don't want to say has fought, but I've been like, okay, the government says this, we know they're doing that. What does that really mean? There's still a lot of baseline capitalism where we look at valuations and we look at what is actually happening with companies looking for the past and the future. And we look at management, and we look at earnings, and we look at the amount of interest rates and compare that to this and what's happening overall from a macro and a microeconomic standpoint and make decisions based on that. But we have really turned into, and I talked about this probably about 4 weeks ago, I talked about this on DH Unplugged. We have turned into a, I would say a hybrid of Japan with quantitative easing infinitum and China, where it seems like the most important thing is not the economics necessarily, but keeping the stock market up. This all started with Ben Bernanke with the wealth effect, where he blatantly told us that the idea of what they're trying to do is to enhance the wealth effect, thereby giving people the feeling that things are pretty good if their 401ks are doing well, if there's money in their bank accounts, if there's money in their stock portfolios, and therefore, when that confidence is high, what they'll do is they'll spend. And by spending, that creates and heals all the other problems in the economy. How different is that from what we see in China? By supporting the markets in a way that they believe is appropriate to make sure their wealth effect goes, because we look over there and say, oh gosh, look what China's doing. They put these commentaries in the paper. They support their companies, even though many of their companies are failing. And if, in fact, the loans that they can't be repaid, they restructure them and say, okay, you know what? Let's wipe out some of this. Let's change this around. Or we'll infuse money into the company. How different are we here? How different are we here when we have the airline companies, for example, failing, but we're giving them massive loans? Where we're seeing that, obviously, people, unfortunately, in terrible situation with regard to losing their jobs, we just give them money. So is the economic cycle even something that we should consider right now? Maybe not. And the market's telling you that. The market's telling you that regardless of how many times we look at this whole pandemic, and no matter how bad it gets, and even the rollbacks that are going on, what everything was predicated on the fact that we were going to reopen, and a lot of things aren't necessarily reopening, and the income cliff is right around the corner. Everybody believes that there's going to be another trillion or so, maybe $1.5 trillion, that are going to be pumped into the economy through various social programs and therefore mitigate some of the economic hardships that we have and keep the stock market levitating, even though a lot of companies are coming out with very poor earnings and outlook, if they even have an outlook. So this is what it's all about right now. The idea that we can look past the economic hardships that are going to be coming in the second quarter when we start seeing all the numbers, the GDP, everything that's out there, the employment numbers, even though we see 1.5 million, 1.3 million numbers of people filing for unemployment, first-time unemployment claims. And even though the U6 number for unemployment is 20% plus, it's okay because the government will provide. Very much opposite and the contra side of what we believed was to be true for the United States capital markets. It is no longer a free market. It's not. Now, if you say to me, Andrew, I believe you. I'm with you. I hear you. What's the alternative right now? And there really isn't much of an alternative that I can think of. I can't. So I agree with a lot of the things that are going on. However, there also needs to be a review of how the money is spent, a little more time taken in crafting the actual stimulus plans, and looking to not just do a deal at the 11th hour for political expedience. But we know one thing. Aside from the pandemic, aside from the markets, aside from everything else, we are in the last few months leading up to an election. And, you know, there is no way that they are just going to stop on a dime the income payments for people that don't have jobs, which they shouldn't, but they're not going to do it. They may talk a big game about, hey, you know what? 70% of the people that are receiving benefits right now may be receiving more money than they would if they were actually working. They may talk a big game about how they're going to do a lot of work to make sure that the money gets to the right place. But at the end of the day, the numbers don't really matter to them right now. $1 trillion, 1.2, 1.5, 1.7 trillion. Let's throw in an infrastructure deal. I mean, why not? Listen, let's just not allow a good crisis go to waste. Where we are right now in terms of where we are situated before an election, they all want to spend money to make sure that things look as good as possible. However that is, before we actually get to the polling booths. So right now, the bet is on. Everybody believes, I think everybody, that there's going to be another stimulus bill that will be passed. Now we're coming up on, what, 2.5 weeks or so until the expiration of the $600 per week of extra benefits paid for by the federal government to people that are unemployed. So they got to move very quickly. And as they're going through this process, there'll be some holes, there'll be some problems, but rest assured, they're going to renew something. Now, whether or not it's going to be the full amount of the $600 per week, Treasury Secretary Mnuchin said that, you know what, it's a disincentive for people to have that much money. If they're making more money now than when they were working, they're not going to really want to go back to work. And there's some, I think that's a reasonable thing to consider, although under normal circumstances, fine. Now, with the pandemic and with the potential for contagion, it's a little bit different. But how much would it take for someone to say, you know what, the hell with it. I will risk getting sick to go back to work. And is that what they're really telling us? So we're butting heads with a ethical and moral dilemma and a financial emergency situation all at the same time. But odds are there's going to be a plan. Now, whether or not they cut it back to, let's say, $500 or $400, or maybe even do some kind of a decreasing process where they say, you know what, we'll extend this for the next month for $600 per week. The month after that, it's going to be $500 a week. Then it's going to be maybe $250, and then it's going to, you know, be zero after that. Or something to the effect where they're going to try, which I don't think they can be very successful in doing so, but say that you're not going to make more than 75% of what you made prior. And somehow they're going to have to look at your tax returns, which isn't fair because that's last year's tax returns. It's not your current situation. It's also not very fair if there is the inability for them to do it quickly because then there's going to be a wait. So I'm not sure how they're going to put this all together, but there's something brewing with that in mind. And as long as we have a reasonable amount and confidence that there's going to be payments that will be made over time, spending can stay up. Now, there's a lot of other things that are going on here, right? We have a hiatus on evictions in a lot of areas, California, Florida being two of the biggest states that have eviction potential. I think Texas also, and New York maybe, with potential for evictions that have been halted until such time in the future. And that time in the future has come upon us now, where landlords were not allowed to evict people in certain circumstances due to the inability to pay. And that was all, again, part of, I think, in the CARES Act. I think it was part of that. Meanwhile, landlords are having difficulty because they can't, you know, make ends meet. But tenants don't have to pay, even though they'll have to pay their back money, of course, eventually. And that's another thing. So we have a lot of things that are really coming up to the wire in 20 days or 50, you know, 18 days or so till the end of the month, where all this needs to be resolved one way or another, whether we just extend or what's going to happen then. And then you line that up with the fact that a lot of places are rolling back or reclosing. Vegas is seeing some reclosings, Florida, Texas, California, although Florida, it's in Miami primarily. The governor here, this guy's a real meathead. This guy, DeSantis, I liked him for a while. And then all of a sudden, I'm like, what is wrong with this guy? Stubborn as can be. It's like he doesn't even see the information that's right in front of him. But nonetheless, he's plowing ahead with reopenings, regardless of the fact that we hit new records of cases, hospitalizations are rising, et cetera. So what we have right now is a situation where it's, again, regional. And we're going to talk about some of that right now because it is also in play, this whole idea of how is this recovery going to shape up? Now, with that, I want to talk about earnings and what's happening because earnings season is upon us. Before we do that, I want to mention a couple things. SPACs, S-P-A-C, SPACs. You got to look this up. I want you to do your homework and check this out because this is kind of something that we saw way back when. I think I talked about this in detail with Frank Curzio recently. Special purpose acquisition companies. It's the old blind pools where there would be companies already trading on the markets, pretty much doing nothing. They were empty. And another company would then fund it, take it over, and maybe do a kind of a buy of another company and bring it in to a currently trading vehicle that's already on the stock market without having to go through the whole entire IPO process. Saves them money instantly there. And there's a variety of these that are on the market right now. We saw this with SPCE, right? We saw this with the Virgin Galactic, and we saw what happened there. It was trading at $10 forever. And then it kind of went up dramatically once Virgin Galactic was shooed into that. There's a few other ones, SPAQ. SPAQ was the big winner this week. And that is potentially, not definitely, but potentially they're looking to do a kind of a reverse merger, if you will, with Fisker Automotive. And there's plenty of other ones out there that have done well. IPOC is another one. That one is currently just open, and we don't know exactly what they're going to do with the money, but it's run by some pretty good people. These SPACs are, there's two things that I want to talk about with them. First thing is, it's a sign of excessive exuberance, maybe irrational exuberance, when we start to see that these kinds of very speculative plays do so well. I think there's something to be said about that. I think we look back 2 years from now, we'll say, oh yeah, hey, look at that. That kind of speculation that goes on, while there may be some great trading opportunities during the period, and some of them may actually do very well moving forward, that was a sign of something. That that was just one of those things that you want to say, okay, let's put that on the list of excess. What are the signs of excess? One of them would be the incredible amount of SPACs that are on the market that have these shoe-ins of other companies, and the stocks go up 30, 40, 50% in a day or so, possibly even hundreds of percent over a few days. And then a lot of them also have extreme volatility, but that's something. I want you to take a look at those, make a list of those just for the fun of it. I want you to keep them on your watch list and look at what's going on with those. And let's keep an eye on some of those. If you have any of those that you want to send to me, please do so. There's some lists that are out there that you could look at. Basically, the bottom line of all this is that, I think it is a sign of excess or where we are in the market. These kinds of things happen when there's a lot of excess liquidity in the markets and a lot of speculation and a lot of froth. So keep an eye on that. All right, earnings season. Earnings season is coming up, and we're also going to be talking about these various shapes of the economic recovery and the market recovery. But earnings season, starting next week, we're going to start to see, I'm going to give you a list right now if you want to either write this down, you want to look at it. On Monday, Pepsi. Pepsi, we're going to be coming out looking for $1.25. Last year was $1.54. So we're kind of looking at a loss, which makes sense for Pepsi compared to last year. Not a loss, but a reduction from last year. But the banks are the big names that are really coming to fore next week. So we have on Tuesday, Citigroup. Expectations are for 30 cents per share profit versus $1.95 last year. Delta Airlines coming out Tuesday, a loss of $4.21 is the consensus versus $2.35 last year. JP Morgan, $1.15 versus $1.24 last year. Not too bad, held up pretty well there. Wells Fargo, which the stock will, if you have a look at a stock chart of Wells Fargo, miserable. And I don't feel bad for that stock. All the things that they did and all the problems they caused and all the, I would say, the bad actors that were seemingly concentrated at Wells Fargo and what was allowed to go on over the years, I don't feel one bit bad for this stock at all, being as low as it is and not having any support. Wells Fargo expectations are for 7 cents a share. Last year, $1.30. Wednesday, Goldman Sachs, $3.89 versus $5.81 a year ago. United Healthcare, $4.04 versus $3.60, and that kind of makes sense. Sleep Number, a loss of 80 cents versus 14 cent profit last year. You know my comments on the mattress firms. Right now is probably a decent time, although they seem to be coming in with a loss. But it should be a good time for mattress firms if, in fact, people are staying at home and saying, hey, you know what? I can't stand sleeping on this mattress anymore. And you know, I'm going to use some of my money to make me a little bit more comfortable. Thursday, Bank of America, 29 cents versus 74 cents a year ago. Domino's Pizza coming in at $2.24 versus $2.19 a year ago. Morgan Stanley, $1.12 versus $1.23. And Friday, we rounded off with BlackRock, which obviously is a big beneficiary of all the excess money that's being poured into ETFs. $6.79 versus $6.41. Regions Financial, 8 cents versus 37. And State Street Bank, $1.59 versus $1.45. So that's next week. And then we start rolling the next week with a lot more names. And then we start getting the technology a week after that. And it's going to be pretty interesting to see exactly if these names can pull up to where the expectations are. There is a low bar for many companies like the banks and the cruise lines and the airlines, and an extremely high bar, I would say, for the technology companies that are going to be reporting. You know which names I'm talking about. All right, now, ISM. So we saw some economic numbers last week, the ISM. We have the manufacturing number and the services number. It used to be called the ISM manufacturing and the ISM non-manufacturing. They changed it to services. Approximately 70% of all U.S. output of GDP is related to services and about 30% to manufacturing. And as we know, the recent drop-off in business activity was due to these mandatory shutdowns and many businesses had to close. And then when companies were allowed to reopen, we saw a significant rebound that took place due to, I guess we can call it, the pent-up demand that was out there. So we look at a chart of the ISM composite, which is calculated using a 70% weighting of services and 30% of manufacturing, which again are the same levels that are generally associated with total U.S. output. It shows very clearly that this has had a really nice V recovery off of the bottom. And assuming that consumers can return to, quote, normal activities and their buying habits, I mean, and we don't have any problems with the pandemic waves coming and going, this looks pretty good. But at this point, if you really consider all that we've seen where we have a shutdown and then a restart, it makes sense that we have this V recovery. But now what happens when we see that consumers retract a bit? They went out and got all the things that they wanted to get, the things they couldn't get before. Maybe they really pushed up demand due to the fact that they were, you know, locked down themselves for a period of time. And now all of a sudden they're allowed out, or at least loosening it up a little bit. And they go out and say, you know what? I'm going to get that barbecue that I always wanted, if they didn't already have it delivered to them previously. But it seems to me that, yeah, we did have this V recovery, especially when it comes to this composite that I looked at. But I'm thinking that instead of this V recovery, we may have a series of rolling W's, or possibly within those rolling W's, a K-shaped recovery. Now, this is something that I just heard about this week, and I looked at it and I said, well, you know, that, now that makes a lot of sense, because I was thinking about, you know, all the different shapes, right? The L, the U, the V, the square root sign, and these W's, but I heard this K. I'm like, hey, I never really heard that before. In all the years that I've been looking at this, the K recovery, what does that, what does that exactly mean? So let's think about the shape for a second, because it kind of makes some sense. It makes sense both from a market standpoint and to a lesser extent, economic recovery, but a K, a capital K, right? You have that in your head? We have a vertical line. Let's look at that as the drop. Let's look at that steep drop due to the sudden stop and the shutdowns that happened, that steep drop on the way down, kind of trace it down from top to bottom. Then we go up about, oh, a little bit, about halfway, and we get a recovery. Now what? Well, in a W-shaped recovery, we're going to come up a little bit more. We may come down, we may come up, we may come down. In a K-shaped recovery, we have to now start thinking about, from that new point that we just made, we now have a steep line that goes and slopes upward and one that slopes down. So from the center point where we had that initial recovery, we now have a breakout, one on the way up, one on the way down. And that gives you the K, right? We line that all up. What that tells us, and it kind of points to, is within the bigger waves, let's say, that there are winners and losers in the stock market, as well as various parts of the economy. So the slope up, when we think about companies on the K, could be like, say, healthcare and technology. And the slope down could be, let's say, financials or leisure-related, restaurants, airline stocks. As far as the economy is concerned, the slope up is like areas maybe in employment as people go back to work, possibly with GDP up to a point, while the slope down is, let's say, housing. No, actually, the slope up would be for housing, now that I think about it. We continue the slope up for housing. And in other areas, we have, you know, that may not be doing well. We could see the continuation of a slope back down for services and manufacturing. You know, again, use your imagination here, but that is something that's very possible, where we see that there is this bifurcation, this split that is split and separated dramatically depending on sectors and components. So, I don't know. Do I buy that? I think it's pretty interesting. I think it's part of a bigger wave. I think it's part of this rolling W's. And then within that, there are kind of K's that will branch off from there, dependent on where we are. In fact, you know, if you think about it, if we have a recovery and then a slowdown across a big swath of businesses, and we think about the virus and the trajectory of what happens there, well, if we see that trend continuing that we're seeing now, where we're having a continuation of an increase in case count and all the other things and concern about reopenings, well, the trend that we have right now is probably the trend that continues. And we'll see the same where we see technology and healthcare and, you know, certain retail on that case slope on the upside. And we'll see the continuation of the cruise line stocks and airlines and banks and, you know, restaurants and movie theaters and travel in general and Disney, all that on the other side of the K. But if we do get a handle on all this and we get maybe better treatments like we saw this week with Gilead, right? We saw that there was some better results with Gilead, maybe a vaccine, dare I say herd immunity. We may see that K reverse. This K will still look like a K, but the winners will become the losers. The loser will become the winners in a major catch-up trade, at least for a while. But let's be honest. There's really way too much uncertainty right now to even speculate. This is all theory on what could happen and where to go. And something to keep in mind as you are appropriately managing your disciplined-based portfolio. Right now, investors are pretty clear. They're voting up, hey, you know what? It's going to be like this, right? Technology is going to take over the world. But in the end, valuations are going to have to matter eventually, aren't they? Eventually. Not right now, maybe, but eventually. But voters are winning the investing. Investors are voting and winning on the whole technology trade and that growth-oriented trade and the areas that are very specific to the stay-at-home. The world is different. Life 2.0. So keep that in mind. I have some listener questions I want to go through. I'm going to do that. A couple of reminders first. Recently, I was the guest on two great podcasts. I was on the Barron Report with Paul Barron. It's a video podcast it's available on YouTube. You can look up the Barron Report, B-A-R-R-O-N. And the title of this episode that I was on was Commercial Real Estate Leases, Renegotiation, and Refusing to Pay. And we talked about the whole area of the commercial real estate market, particularly in the areas of the metro centers and how things are going to play out there with this deurbanization trend and what it looks like for many of the businesses that surround and feed off of all the people that work downtown somewhere. I was also the guest on Wall Street Unplugged this week with Frank Curzio. We covered a ton of areas between economics, and we talked a lot about stocks. We talked about a whole range of topics that was really interesting. So check that out. And you can see that over on, check out, just look up Frank Curzio, Wall Street Unplugged. Follow me on Twitter. I always tweet these things. The Twitter handle is Andrew Horowitz. It's just one word, Andrew Horowitz. And check that out. And you will get first dibs on anything that we talk about on the show. Of course, also want to mention one more thing that you can listen to myself and John C. Dvorak on Tuesday nights. If you haven't done this already, whether you get the podcast and you can go over to iTunes and grab it, or you listen live, we live stream at 9 p.m. Eastern time every Tuesday. Been doing that for years. We have a chat room. It's really fun. We talk about the lighter side of news. We talk about some personal anecdotes. We talk about what's going on around the world, but really focused on finance, investment, and business. So check that out, and I think you'll really enjoy that. And finally, if you haven't done so already, please leave a review on iTunes or any of the other podcast repositories or services that you listen. I like to look at those and find out what you're thinking about the show, etc. So with that, let's get to some listener questions. And there's two ways that you can actually ask a question. You can go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com. You could ask a question by clicking on the Ask Andrew button, and you could just submit a question. Just type it up, submit it. It will get right to us. The other way is that you can actually go and record your question, your voice, asking the question, and we'll bring it right into the show. You can hear yourself on the show like we have coming up in a second. So either way works just fine. So let's get to those questions.
Hey, Andrew. This is Jack. Great idea about this hotline. Now that whatever keeps me up at night, I'll give you a call and then go back to sleep soundly.
Yeah.
First question is JNUG, the Junior Gold Mining 2X ETF, and it's 2X inverse JDST. Lost about 95% and 71% last year, respectively. How so? The second question is JNUG, the 2X ETF, has pretty much the same top 10 holdings as GDXJ, which is a 1X junior mining ETF. But GDXJ was up 56% last year, and JNUG lost pretty much everything. I just want to know, do you know why? Thank you so much. Bye.
Good stuff. So, Jack, one of the problems you have is when looking at these ETFs, particularly the ones that are multiplier or leveraged, the problem is that these are really supposed to be for either very short-term holdings. You know, I mean, short-term, what is that? It could be a week, 2 weeks, whatever period that is. But they have a daily rebalancing that happens there, and it's supposed to be equivalent to the daily returns. And when you start looking at when you leverage them up 2 and 3 times, and you look at what happens over time with the slippage, that's what happened in this particular circumstance. What happened here is that you had two similar names, and one of them just didn't do it at all, right? One of them almost lost everything. Because when you have a situation with the doubles and you have the doubles moving against the same position for a period of time and you start losing, it kind of multiplies the situation. They have to rebalance over time. So there is a natural degradation of the values of these. I always tell people, if you're going to use any of the leveraged ETFs, and especially ones that are commodity related, these are more stocks, you have to be really careful with this degradation, because it will continually be a problem over time. What you want to do is just buy the single, if that's what you're buying. And if you want to trade the leverage, trade around it, whether it's for a day or week, even a couple of weeks, maybe a little bit more than that. But that's about it. Now, there are certain ones that act differently that are a little bit different to this discussion. I'll pull those out. But generally speaking, a lot of these have a natural degradation of the value of the company. And what happens is the way they're designed is if you see a lot of volatility or directional move in one way or the other, it can really be a compounding effect that is very problematic for the underlying share value. So hopefully it helps out with that. And they're just not really great instruments for long-term holds. That's the bottom line.
Hey, Andrew, Jerry from Cleveland. Yeah, I've been looking at the Qs, QQQ, TQQQ, because I want to get more exposure to the NASDAQ over the next few years. But it seems like they only cover the top 100 stocks in the NASDAQ, which is made up of like 3,000 stocks. And I already own Microsoft and Amazon and Apple and Google outright, so that seemed redundant. So I was wondering if you know of any index funds that covered more the mid-cap, small-cap area of technology companies or the NASDAQ, or something that covered more than the top 100. Appreciate your answer. I've been listening for 10 years, and thank you very much for all you do. Bye-bye.
You know, this is a great question, because this is something we've been talking about, the whole issue of the predominance of some of the major names, not only in the NASDAQ, but also in the S&P index and other indices. And as the market cap of some of these names, you know, the names, the Apples, the Microsofts, the Netflix, the Amazons, the Teslas. As these names get bigger and bigger, they have a much greater amount of holding or weight inside of these. So the NASDAQ 100 is the actual ETF that a lot of people own. The problem that you're having is that you have current holdings personally, and then there's a lot of overlap. I mean, I would suggest that maybe you look outside of there. I mean, you can look at XLK as something that's a technology ETF, but maybe look outside of that entirely and get some diversification, and maybe even think about the international space, emerging markets. You know, you have this great amount. Maybe you want to buy some of the Qs. I don't know, you know, possibly to enhance what you have already, but try to go outside for diversification. Now, that's not the answer you were looking for. The fact is, there's not a really good answer right now, because even if you buy the Dow Jones Industrial Average, Apple and Microsoft are big, Intel are big positions in there. And that may not help you with diversification either. And that's the problem right now with markets. You may want to look at, for example, some of the Russell 1000 or the Russell 3000. That's not technology. But if you want diversification, look outside of that. You can look at the small cap, mid cap, or the SMIDs, as we call it, inside the Russell. So there's a Russell 1000 ETFs that are out there. You could find them very easily. And maybe bend yourself a little bit into that, and that will give you a lot more coverage and a lot more diversification. But still, even with that, if anything you can go near on the large cap side is going to have a lot of the names that you may be already holding due to the fact of what's happened with the big run-up on these in the market. So there's not really a good answer if you're looking for technology exposure, because all these ETFs are going to hold these names in it. Let's get on to the next and final question.
Hey, Andrew. It's Nathan Clay from Bloomington, Illinois. I'm a younger guy. I'm 20 and have a pretty long-term outlook. And I'm trying to decide if I should tilt out of U.S. and go more international, with like Vanguard having expected value returns being a lot higher there. So I'm just wondering your thoughts on that. Thanks.
I mean, I think there's something to be said about that. We just talked about that a second ago on the call. A question that came in from Jeremy, I think there is a lot of opportunity outside the U.S., and we have a component of our portfolios dedicated to non-U.S. That's broken up into developed markets as well as emerging markets. The emerging markets could do really well, in fact, if the dollar starts to lose some of its strength, as we've been seeing and happening recently. That's something to consider. But from a diversification standpoint, I think it also makes a lot of sense, because there have been many years that the non-U.S. exposure has done much better than U.S. exposure. And right now, with the U.S. being a lot worse shape in terms of the pandemic and the potential for where we are from an economic standpoint to a degree, that may benefit the non-U.S. security. So, yeah, check out the emerging markets if you want to be aggressive. Something to consider. There's ETFs and mutual funds that do that. There's also a good amount of area in the developed world that can be, I think, beneficial too. Again, all depends. If the U.S. starts to pick up, that helps them. If the dollar rolls down, that can be beneficial for them. I also think that if, in fact, there is a desire to get outside the U.S., if valuations continue to be just outside of norms, that maybe there's some opportunity that people are looking for to get valuations that are a little bit better in line. So I think that's a very good idea. So I'm glad you thought of it. Our last question comes in. This is written by Ryan R. He says, hey, Andrew, recently you discussed companies manipulating their earnings reports to show that they would have made what they would have made if COVID didn't hit, or adjusted earnings to add the cost of the crisis to their profits, profit line, etc. But I'm wondering, is this legal? It seems that it opens up a new realm of deceiving financial reports. I guess in a nutshell, I could say this has been done for a very long time. And the fact of the matter is that, you know, whether they decide to recognize revenue in one quarter or say maybe it's in the next quarter, and that's why we have this non-GAAP and this GAAP kind of reporting, as well as the fact that, yeah, it's legal. Now, unless they are recognizing phantom income or making up expenses out of the blue that aren't real, but I don't think that's what's happening. I think they're just adjusting the timing on some of this that is probably footnoted somewhere in some of the numbers. Companies do this all the time. They recognize and say, okay, we're going to book that for second quarter when it may be first quarter, or bring it into first quarter that is second quarter, and appropriately denote that and recognize that in their financial statements, as well as somewhere deep inside the footnotes and the fine print, I don't think that's necessarily a problem. So I think that is something we have to watch for, but I think it happens all the time. So not to be surprised by that. All right, that's going to be the end of this show. I want to thank everybody for joining me. Thank you for sending in your questions. Thank you for recording your questions. We'll be around next week again on the Disciplined Investor Podcast, as well as all the other places that we show up on the web. Thanks for joining me. Be safe. Be healthy. Best to your family. Best to you. Talk to you soon. Thanks so much. Nothing discussed in this podcast should be considered a recommendation to buy or sell any security. Past performance is no indication of future results. In addition, the information presented is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should be construed as advice designed to meet the individual needs of any particular investor. Nothing herein constitutes legal, accounting, or tax advice, or individually tailored investment advice. Remember, investing involves substantial risk. Past performance is not a guarantee of future results, and a loss of original capital may occur. No one receiving or accessing this information should make any investment decision without first consulting his or her own personal financial advisor and conducting his or her own research and due diligence, including carefully reviewing any applicable prospectuses, press releases, reports, and other public filings of the issuer of any securities being considered. Please consider this for educational purposes only. As always, use your best judgment when investing. Horowitz & Company, Inc. is registered as an investment advisor with the state of Florida and conducts business in other states where it is properly registered or is excluded from registration requirements. Registration does not imply any level of skill or training.